We are losing the war against cancer, and it's about time we admitted it, says oncologist Dr. Azra Raza. She's been on the front line of the insidious disease for 30 years. And she says that cancer research promises hope and delivers disappointment. She sees the suffering and failure as a doctor and also as a woman who cared for her husband who died from leukemia. She believes that we need to put more efforts into prevention and early detection. Her book is called The First Cell and the Human Costs of Pursuing Cancer to the Last. And she joins me now. Hello there.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. You write that the slash poison burn approach to treating cancer remains unchanged and that it's an embarrassment. You say equally embarrassing is the arrogant denial of that embarrassment. So why is our cancer treatment an embarrassment?
The good news is that we are curing 68% of our cancers who are diagnosed today. The bad news is we are still using the same old techniques that have been introduced ages ago. The 32% who we are not curing because they present with advanced disease, the same treatments, chemotherapy, radiation therapy, surgery, which work in earlier stages of the disease, are completely useless when some of these cancers are advanced. And so for those 32% that we are not curing, the outcome is really no different than it was 50 years ago. That's why I say this.
Has your attitude about treatments evolved since you began treating cancer patients 30 years ago?
No, because the problem is that despite spending hundreds of billions of dollars in trying to understand the biology of cancer and reverse the abnormalities that have converted a normal cell into a cancerous one, we have not come up with better therapies for the majority of common cancers. Now, I'm not denying for a minute that there haven't been advances, but they have helped smaller numbers of patients that can be counted in thousands a year at best. For example, antibodies in lymphomas have worked very well. Some targeted therapies are working well. Some immune therapies are working well. But when you look at the cancer problem as a whole, then the problem is that it's just minuscule compared to the nature of the issue, which is affecting 1.7 million new cancer patients every year in the United States.
Cancer is very cunning. Your book is called The First Cell. And how smart is that first cancer cell?
Well, I wouldn't put it in those anthropomorphic terms of being cunning and smart. The issue is that every cell is capable of becoming cancerous because during a process of multiplication, it has to copy its DNA, and copying errors are made regularly. And a vast majority of cancers result from accumulation of these DNA copying errors. So it's not that the cell is very smart. It's just that repeating that same algorithm and retaining mistakes over several generations, the cell can then go awry and start misbehaving. But it still retains a lot of its normal characteristics. And this is one of the challenges of cancer, that we are unable to distinguish between a normal cell and a cancerous cell, even with such incredibly well-designed and engineered therapies such as CAR-Ts, the cell therapies taking advantage of the body's own immune system. Even that cannot distinguish between a normal cell and a cancerous one. So this is how you can say it's very smart, but it's really a matter of complexity arising from accumulation of simple algorithmic repetitive functions.
Yes, you write that it is a perfect example of intelligence at a molecular level, able to perceive its environment and take actions that maximize its chances of survival. That's you writing as a doctor. But you're not just a doctor who treats cancer patients, because your husband sadly died from leukemia. And you say that until I shared a bed with a cancer patient, I had no idea how unbearably painful a disease it could be. and he was a cancer doctor too. Did your joint knowledge about cancer help you each make better decisions or save him from any suffering?
That's a very good question, because it's one of the reasons I actually wrote this book, is to clarify my own thinking about cancer. It is such a complex issue, and we know that for every complex question, there is an answer that's clear, simple, and wrong. Because it's very hard to take the complexity of literally life and try to make linear narratives out of it. They say that anyone who's not confused is not paying attention. And I agree, because everything looks okay as long as you leave out the details. Soon as you start filling in the details, the complexity that arises is immense. So as long as I'm looking at a distance at patients, meeting them in clinic, it's a very different thing, advising them to go home and start this treatment. But when I'm accompanying that person home and giving that treatment and seeing the consequences of that treatment at home, that's a very different story. Now, your question is, did the combined efforts of my husband and I, both being oncologists and having been in practice for practically 20, 25 years prior to his diagnosis, did that make a difference? No, not really, because whatever the best treatments are available, we kept trying the same things. And today I would take the same treatments also, because as humans, we are no different. We want to give ourselves the chance. So the same treatment that I'm criticizing so much, the slash, poison, and burn, if I have cancer today, I will take all of them also, because that's the only thing we have to give. But my question is, why? Why is that the only choice? Why haven't we done better? And for Harvey, my late husband, that was the same issue. We kept trying whatever was available, but also I kept asking this question.
What hope do the rest of us have of understanding cancer and treatment options if two oncologists struggle?
I think that the outcome is not necessarily different when you treat an oncologist who knows what to expect, rather than someone who's not related to the medical field. For example, hope is a kind of a parasite, an emotional parasite, which one of my friends just used these terms to describe my book. That hope is like an emotional parasite which keeps us going, but which also drains our bone marrows dry. And the idea here is that both Harvey and I were oncologists. We would, let's say, look at an MRI and see that the tumor is expanding despite all the chemotherapy. Now, he knew exactly what it meant, because he's himself the cancer center director. And he was not someone who was easily duped or was waiting to be given delusional kind of hope. Yet, the human in him would still turn to me and ask, so what do you think as? Because at some level, he had to suspend his judgment and depend on me to decide how he should think. And that was asking for hope, is what it was doing. And I took infinite care never to break his spirit, just the way I do with all the other patients. So when you say, what hope do we have as non-medical people to deal with cancer? I don't think it's any different than having cancer as oncologists. It adds a burden to the oncologist, because you, on the one hand, know what to expect, and on the other hand, you are also hopeful, just like everybody else, that maybe I'll be that unicorn who'll do differently. Mm. So in fact, the burden is added to the oncologist being treated for cancer, rather than lay people who at least can suspend their judgment and depend on their doctors to decide for them.
I'm speaking with Dr. Azra Raza, who is author of the book The First Cell and the Human Costs of Pursuing Cancer to the Last. She talks about her treatment of patients and what it was like to care for her husband, another cancer doctor who died from leukemia. I wanted to mention this quote that you have included in your writing, Marcel Proust, who says that the real voyage doesn't lie in finding new landscapes, but in having new eyes. That's a good one. And did that happen for you?
In a way, it did, because it helped me to distinguish between curiosity and wonder. Curiosity is where we are looking for answers and explanations. But wonder is something completely different. Wonder is what takes everything we know and stands it on its head. Suddenly makes it all very unexpected or inexplicable. So what started happening to me until the point just being an oncologist and a cancer researcher driven by curiosity, I think what got added was this kind of unexpected things that would suddenly shock me by interactions with patients. And I think that's the voyage of discovery that has led me to start the book by saying I could not have written this book when I was 30 years old, because you need to walk the walk. You need this kind of a journey, walking patient with your patients and watching them unravel with all these unexpected twists and turns that and the challenges that the disease throws your way. So I think it is a voyage of discovery and of wonder.
Now, you say that instead of focusing on cancer once it's long past that first cell, we should be focusing on something else. And even CAR T-cell treatment that everyone's pretty excited about here in New Zealand at the moment, even that falls into the category for you of focusing too late in the process. What should we be focusing on in our research?
Let me summarize this as briefly as possible. So my colleague Siddharth Mukherjee, who has written the book Emperor of All Maladies, took the example of Queen Atossa, who lived 550 BC, the daughter of Cyrus the Great in Egypt and the wife of Darius. She was the queen. She noticed a bleeding lump in her breast, and any number of physicians would have flocked to her bedside because she was the queen to help take care of her, but she somehow hid it. And then as it kept growing, she asked one of her Greek slave, who took out his sword and slashed her breast off. And this is the first description of cancer and of a patient who survived, of a tumor, and she survived this. So we started slashing breasts for cancer in 550 BC. We are still doing the same. There was a lot of interest in trying to poison cancer all along. And in the First World War, which we call the Great War, because we didn't know there was going to be a second war, so we couldn't call it the First War. Mm-hmm. In the Great War, chemical weapons were discovered. And when these were dropped on humans, it was discovered that their blood counts fell. So during the Second World War, when people were looking for more chemical weapons, two pharmacologists, Goodman and Gilman at Yale, decided to make use of this observation for cancer patients, that if it can drop, these chemical weapons can drop the counts of blood counts of individuals who are exposed to them, maybe we should be using them in blood cancers in patients with cancer. And that's how chemotherapy started after the Second World War, using chemical weapons. Cytoxin, chlorambucil, melphalan, these drugs that were directly derived from nitrogen mustard, the gas used and the chemical used to as a weapon, is still being used today. These three drugs are the mainstay of chemotherapy for so many cancers today. And all of this is, if you look at, this is the history of cancer treatment. In between, we have spent billions of dollars trying to understand what causes cancer And no matter whether it's an environmental exposure, a hereditary reason, or it is a pathogen, some kind of infection causing it, or it's idiopathic, we don't know anything. The ultimate thing is that the cell starts misbehaving and cell is directed in its function by genes. So scientists started to obsess over abnormalities and mutations in genes. And the question was, is there one gene that's gone abnormal for each cancer? That way we could find a one magic bullet to cure the cancer. And this worked for a couple of cancers. Chronic myeloid leukemia, acute promyelocytic leukemia are curable with one magic bullet. But then the majority of all other cancers turned out to have hundreds, if not thousands, of genes misbehaving, mutated or abnormally functioning. So how do you deal with that? And all these years have been spent in trying to deal with this problem. In the meantime, death rates from cancer are falling by 1% a year for the last 30 years, so that they're down by 27% today. However, this decrease in mortality is not from any great new treatments, but it is because of anti-smoking campaigns showing their results finally, and because we learned to diagnose cancers in earlier stages. Those are the two reasons that mortality has fallen. Just this week, there is a long article in Scientific American by the science writer John Horgan, who points out that for the cancer mortality rates, if you adjust them for age, then it is no different today than it was in 1930. So that's like 90 years ago. The mortality from cancer was the same, because people forget to note that, yes, there's a 30% decrease in mortality, but before that, there was a 60% increase in mortality because of smoking. And all that's happened is 30% came down because of anti-smoking campaigns. You should really refer to this article that has just been published with some gruesome statistics, which I have also tried to point out in the book. So the whole time now, what I'm saying is you take slash poison burn approach and you combine it with early detection of cancer because of screening measures and awareness, etc., using mammograms, using PSA and using pap smears and using colonoscopies, diagnosing cancer early, treating them with the slash poison burn. Yes, we have gotten somewhere, but let's try to imagine in the future, which way are we going? Immune therapies, I just pointed out to you. There's excitement about CAR-Ts, but CAR-Ts have been around for 7 years now. We are unable to expand their use because of not just their financial cost and physical toxicity, but also their inability to target the cancer cell. They kill the entire organ against which they're directed. So the only thing they are approved for in the US is B cells, which are a kind of blood immune cells. B cell cancers like lymphoma, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, they express a marker on their surface, CD19. We target T cells to go kill any cell expressing CD19. But it kills all the normal cells expressing CD19. So that after the treatment is done, if the patient survives all the toxic effects of killing billions of cells in their body suddenly and choking up the kidneys, etc., then we have to replace the B cell function for the rest of their lives by giving them intravenous immunoglobulin infusions. But you can't kill off the whole organ, liver or pancreas, by using T cells. So the treatment hasn't been that effective trying to kill every last cancer cell. Chemotherapy is horrible. These CAR T therapies are terrible, very toxic, and applicable only to 7,000 cases out of 1.7 million. So what are we imagining for the future is my question. Well, the only strategy that has worked so far is early detection and early intervention. So why not go for really early detection and not using technology that was invented 50 years ago, like mammograms and pap smears? How about using, I'm asking that we should really try and use the latest technology imaging and scanning devices, the proteomics, metabolomics, transcriptomics, genomics, all this technology to identify the earliest footprints of cancer and try to nip the whole thing in the bud and prevent cancer from becoming the end stage monstrosity that is so hard to control.
I know that you will know about some of the arguments against preventative tests. Mammograms and prostate cancer tests now come with concerns about overdiagnosis and overtreatment. Can we overcome that issue?
Well, obviously there are problems with these, but would you stop doing mammograms for women now because some have been overdiagnosed? No, of course not. The real issue is we need to develop better technology. You can't give up the idea that the only thing that works is early detection because you don't have a good technology for early detection. You want to give it up? No, we need to do 20 different tests to make sure that it is not only a tumor, but it is an aggressive tumor that is posing a potential threat to someone's life before we take action on it.
Dr. Raza, are there any tests that resemble that in the world right now, or is it a dream?
No, of course there are. I'll give you two examples. Grail is a company in America which has just announced positive data showing early detection of 12 cancers from the blood. And these are deadly types of cancers that can be detected very early now. And a new machine can detect 13 types of cancers from a single drop of blood in 2 hours for $180, announced by Toshiba in Japan. There is at Stanford's Canary Center for Early Detection of Cancer. They are testing a smart bra that women can wear for 2 hours a week, and that's better than a mammogram. So in other words, can we continuously monitor the human body as if it is a machine as opposed to doing yearly tests using old technology? That's the difference. Now, I'm not saying we should divert all resources to finding the first cell because we have cancer patients today and we need to find better treatments for them. So yes, we should continue investing at least half of our resources in chasing after the last cell and treating patients we have now. But I'm saying that there's a lot of waste in cancer research, Me Too mentality, lots of clinical trials testing the same drug. We don't need 3,000 clinical trials to look for an active checkpoint inhibitor as immune therapy. Each trial costing $100 to $150 million. Some of that money can be better used for investing into better technology for earlier detection. This is what I'm saying. And it may come with its own challenges of overdiagnosis, but I'm not saying that everything will be resolved. I'm saying that at least a new strategy is needed. It will come with its own problems and challenges, and we need to solve those as they come. And treatment will co-evolve with early detection, and early detection not by just one test, but by 20 tests looking at blood, sweat, tears, urine, everything we have to. And there are companies looking at potential lethality of each of these biomarkers as well.
The Scientific American article you mentioned, if it's the same one I read, notes that 43 of the 48 top spenders among cancer treatment providers, quote, deceptively promote atypical patient experiences through the use of powerful testimonials. And that goes to that parasite hope that you referred to earlier. Can we finish perhaps by asking you what advice you can offer someone listening right now who has cancer or knows someone with cancer?
Yes, I would like to tell people who have cancer right now to remain hopeful. There's hundreds of thousands of people worrying about you, trying to do their best to help you. And with the same treatments, if a number of people have failed, a number of people have also responded beautifully. So while you should have the pessimism of the intellect, you must maintain the optimism of will, which basically boils down to you understand intellectually that it's a serious issue, it's a life-threatening issue you may be facing, but that there's always hope because no oncologist can predict how you're going to respond. So do the very best to follow the advice of your oncologist. They know what they're doing. They know what is the best treatment available. And please don't lose hope. And for the future cancer patients, I'm extremely optimistic. I am going to declare that the next coming decade is the decade of early detection and prevention of cancer.
It's such a privilege to meet you. Thank you so much, Dr. Azra Raza. The book is called The First Cell and the Human Costs of Pursuing Cancer to the Last. And there's so much more in the book. We've just scratched the surface here, really. Thanks for your time today. Good luck.
You asked very important questions. I hope I didn't get distracted too much.
Not at all. I love chatting to you, so thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.